The American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails.
Thank you. Me too.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio's KPFK in Los Angeles,
it's so hard to
this is your broadcast, as heard on 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, 99.5 FM Ridgecrest and China Lake, 91.7 FM KYAQ on the beautiful Oregon Central Coast, 93 FM WLRI in lovely Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and of course, coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org on iTunes, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, and Radio Sputnik 5 days a week. You can run, but you can't hide. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us for another thrilling adventure that we call the Bradcast. It is, of course, a special broadcast today as we are following up once again on a debate, this time the very first Democratic debate for 2016, even though it is only 2015. In any event, as most listeners by now know, listeners to the broadcast know that we focus more on the fight for democracy itself in this country rather than the horse races that play out within it. For example, on yesterday's broadcast, if you missed it, you can download it anytime at bradcast.com, bradblog.com, sorry about that, bradblog.com, or over at the archives, of course, at kpfk.org. Yesterday, we took on Fox News and Judge Andrew Napolitano's incredible assertion that California's new motor voter bill, which was just signed over the weekend by the governor, that new motor voter bill will now allow non-citizens to vote in this state. Yes, that's actually what they said on Fox News. And they weren't misspeaking. It was incredible. Now, that new law, which was signed by the governor, allows for registration of eligible voters when they carry out any business with the DMV. It automatically signs them up to be voters. It may result in as many as 6.5 million new voters out here in the Golden State. But Fox News is lying about it. So, as Dean Logan, the county clerk of Los Angeles County, which is the largest voting jurisdiction in the nation, the one that I happen to live and vote in, by the way, Dean Logan explained to us in an exclusive statement for the broadcast that the law allows no such thing. It allows only eligible voters, in other words, those that are citizens, for example, to be registered to vote. And after we got off the air, we also heard back from the Office of Secretary of State Alex Padilla out here in California, who confirmed what County Clerk Dean Logan had to say about that law and confirmed that Fox News, what they were telling viewers, was categorically false. You can listen to the full episode, as I say, over at bradblog.com or the archives at kpfk.org. But that's the sort of thing we usually focus on. The mechanics of democracy, or what is left of it in this country. But on days like today, following a major political debate, well, it's a bit more difficult to avoid the horse race. And to that end, the first Democratic debate was a stark contrast on Tuesday night from those that we have seen so far this year on the Republican side of the aisle, where the contest has been a blur of personal attacks and one-liners and really entertaining food fights with Donald Trump. But Democrats were on the stage in Las Vegas on Tuesday night, focused largely on far more substantive issues and policies. Though there were a few more fireworks between candidates than many of the Beltway geniuses had predicted beforehand. In any event, the debate included discussions of climate change, imagine that, renewable energy, college affordability, prescription drugs, terrorism, civil liberties, and so forth, even though the debate moderator, Anderson Cooper, at times, in my opinion, seemed to do his best to offer up right-wing and/or Beltway talking points in the guise of questions. But perhaps the best description for the evening came from Governor Martin O'Malley, one of the five participants, former Baltimore governor. And in his closing remarks for the debate, I think he may have summed things up just about as well as anybody.
What you heard tonight was a very, very different debate than from the two presidential Republican debates. On this stage, you didn't hear anyone denigrate women. You didn't hear anyone make racist comments about new American immigrants. You didn't hear anyone speak ill of another American because of their religious belief. What you heard instead on this stage tonight was an honest search for the answers that'll move our country forward. I truly believe that we are standing on the threshold of a new era of American progress. Talk to our young people under 30, because you'll never find among them people that want to bash immigrants or people that want to deny rights to gay couples.
That was Governor Martin O'Malley last night in his closing statement. And of course, that may or may not be the last we hear of Governor Martin O'Malley during today's discussion. In any event, it was largely an opportunity for many in America to compare and contrast the two front runners, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, side by side for the first time, with many seeing Sanders for the first time at all on a national level, and many hearing about substantive issues from Clinton for a change, after the corporate media has largely been obsessed with the phony GOP-created scandals concerning Benghazi and her email server and so much else for so long. In any event, here to talk about all of this today for the hour is our special guests, Heather Digby Parton, who we're delighted to have back. She's joined us so far for all of the debates so far this year. Of course, she is known as just Digby quite often from Digby's Hullabaloo blog. She's a contributing writer to Salon and the 2014 recipient of the Sidney Hillman Foundation's Prize for Opinion and Analysis Journalism. Heather Digby Parton, welcome back to the broadcast.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
Always great to have you here. And joining us is another old friend who we haven't had him on for a while, though, so it's good to have him back. Eric Bollert, senior fellow at Media Matters for America. He's the author of Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changes Politics and the Press, and Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. Previously, he wrote on staff for Salon and Rolling Stone, but you can find his excellent work at MediaMatters.org. Hey, Eric, welcome back to the broadcast.
Hi, Brad. Thanks for having me.
Okay, sort of an old-school bloggers day today. as a matter of fact, Eric, I'm going to guess, I don't remember, but you probably wrote about or at least cited Heather Digby Parton in Bloggers on the Bus. Am I guessing right about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I interviewed her. I went out to Santa Monica and we chatted about her amazing tale on the internet. It was great.
All right.
Yep.
Also here with us today, as usual, our producer, Desi Doyen, my co-host on the Green News Report as well. How are you, Desi Doyen?
I'm doing well. It was a fascinating debate.
Well, we'll see how fascinating it was. All right, before we get to that, last time we, after the Republican debate, Heather, we talked about, we had you and Fred Karger, former Republican candidate for in the 2014. Wait, I'm losing my math. 2012 presidential race, Republican. We talked about conflicts of interest. Do you have a candidate, a dog in this hunt so far, Heather?
You know what? I don't. I mean, I've long been a major supporter and fan of Bernie Sanders. You know, I'm way over on the left side of the dial, so everything he says just, you know, rings true to me. But also, I am, you know, thoroughly convinced that Hillary Clinton would be a fine president, and as a huge part of me, I am a woman, and it would be a thrilling thing for me to see the first woman president. So this is one of those great races for me on the Democratic side where I feel really good
wow.
about the candidates that are in it, and I am, you know, I'm happy to watch this thing unfold as it will.
Now, you do have, we should say, you are founder or co-founder of ACT, which one is it?
Blue America.
Blue America, thank you. And Blue America has been supporting Bernie Sanders or helping to raise money for him. Am I correct on that?
Yes. Okay. We, in fact, we had a draft Bernie Sanders page on our ACT Blue for years. Literally for years. So, Bernie Sanders was kind of the dream presidential candidate for Blue America for many years. I personally have not endorsed either one, and I actually don't plan to. I'll be happy to support either one in the general election.
And Eric Bollert, before Andrew Breitbart died, he explained to me very clearly that you and Media Matters for America were in the tank for Hillary Clinton. So would you like to give us your full conflict of interest in that regard?
I'm sure that's just one of many truths he told you about Media Matters. Obviously, David Brock founded Media Matters. David Brock, as people see on television, is a Hillary supporter and has been close with the Clintons for years. Media Matters is just in the business of media misinformation. I've written columns about what I think is crummy Bernie Sanders media coverage and how they're not covering enough. Certainly people have made that claim about Media Matters that were in the tank. They made that same claim in 2008, and I've probably written 200 or 300 articles defending Barack Obama since, you know, from right-wing nonsense. So we're in the business of right-wing misinformation, and that's what we do.
And you have not personally come out one way or another for any particular
case. No.
I follow your Twitter feed, and you have been, nothing wrong with this, but you have been very supportive of Hillary Clinton, at least in response to the attacks from the right.
Well, it all revolves around the media, you know, and particularly on Twitter. You know, I don't wake up every day thinking, I can't wait to read awful Hillary coverage. But by, like, the time I'm not even done with breakfast, my blood pulse is, like, way too high. I mean, I'll just give you, like, a quick example. Like, last week or, you know, within the last week, you know, she set the record for a non-incumbent. She raised the most money in the third quarter of any non-incumbent candidate ever. Mm-hmm. And I'm not kidding. The Washington Post listed that as bad news for her. I mean, so you read stuff like this, and you read about her collapsing campaign, and you're just like, what planet am I living on? What happened to just kind of describing what's unfolding in the campaign? When did we get into the invention and the fantasy business in terms of campaign coverage? So that's where, you know, mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton has clearly been the target of some of the craziest, probably most dishonest campaign coverage that I've seen, and I've been watching this a long time. So I think that's why people probably might see me as synonymous with, you know, with her campaign or defending her or things like that.
Desi Doyen, do you have a candidate so far in this race, one way or another?
No, I don't. But, okay. You know, I was very impressed with the subject matter that was covered. It seemed very substantive last night, very much unlike the Republican debates that we've been seeing. So, you know, I'm pretty pleased with the crop that we have right now at the moment to choose from.
You said crop. Right?
Crop, that's probably okay. Not the right word.
No,
the
that's
field.
Okay. I wasn't sure to say crop or crap, but
no,
okay.
No, I said crop. And crop for, like in a field, you know, yeah. And I think that I just want to point out really quick before we get too far past this. You know, Eric, you mentioned what planet are they on? And I think that that is primarily the big difference between the GOP debates and the Democratic debates. They are on two different planets, different realities.
And we're getting ahead of ourselves because actually Heather wrote about exactly that at Salon today about the two different planets that these parties are on.
Well, great minds think alike,
there
obviously.
There you go. but we'll get to that in a moment. And me, just for the record, I support no candidates and I probably won't throughout the entire election. I figure that all of the candidates have enough supporters. I support the voters and their ability to vote, even for terrible candidates. So that's just me. All right. Anything either of you would like to say about either Lincoln Chafee or Jim Webb's contribution to the debate last night, or even Martin O'Malley for that matter, before we get into the meat of this thing, because I don't want to be accused of ignoring them completely, and we may never get back to them at all. So, Heather, let me start with you. Any thoughts on those guys, just in case we don't get back to them here?
Well, I mean, I think that Lincoln Chafee will be recalled for saying that he is a block of granite. I don't know if that's exact. You know, they used to say Al Gore was a wooden candidate, and Chafee, now he's a block of granite. And Jim Webb will be remembered for pretty much saying, you know, he shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. And I don't know that anybody's ever done that in a presidential campaign, presidential debate before. So those would be my takeaways on those two guys.
Now, to be clear, of course, he didn't shoot the man in Reno. He shot the man while he was serving valiantly, I suppose, in the Vietnam War. He was a hero, and he did kill a man. But you're right. I was struck by, hey, who's this Republican guy on the? Jim Webb would be a really good candidate for the Republican Party, would he not?
They were loving him. Ann Coulter was tweeting, I love this guy. And then he said something she didn't like. I can't remember because she's, okay, I'm back to Trump. But, yeah, I mean, she was very excited, and I was seeing a lot of Trump-Webb, discussion among the right-wing tweeters.
Trump-Webb 2016.
Yes, and the fact is that, you know, in the Drudge poll, Webb came in second. So, you know, I mean, I think that just shows what a tremendous appearance he made last night. So.
Eric Bullard, why is Martin O'Malley running? Is he running for president or is he running for vice president?
On paper, his resume looks like exactly what you would do in the past. You know, rising star, Democratic Party, mayor, governor, eastern, a state with a big population. It just hasn't clicked. I'm not entirely sure why. He says some interesting things. Obviously, he's overshadowed by both Sanders and Clinton. What's interesting about Webb, though, and Heather started at the beginning saying she's loving this debate. She loves both the main candidates, and she's a liberal. We kind of lose sight that, you know, for decades, there wasn't a lot for liberals to like on Democratic presidential debates. You know, there was a lot of blue dog Democrats. How do you appeal to those moderates? You know, the NRA bashing that went on last night was unthinkable, a decade or two ago, because Democrats were so afraid, you know, about losing those votes. And Jim Webb kind of represented the type of candidate we often saw on a Democratic debate stage. And it was interesting, last night he was so far out of, you know, step with the rest of the party, the rest of the candidates, and the rest of the Democratic voters. So he was a helpful, I think, reminder of where sort of, frankly, you know, corporate Democratic Party was a few decades ago, and frankly, the very exciting direction it's going in now.
And actually, let me do one more question. We'll come back, and hopefully we'll get to some audio from that gun exchange. And you're right, it was rather remarkable. They were all bragging about, no, I have a D-minus from the NRA. No, I have an F from the NRA. It was kind of incredible. So we'll get to some of that in a minute. I'm going to take a quick break. But before I do, Eric Bullard, you had tweeted last night during the debate that the chances of Biden's running fell by double digits tonight. That thought was echoed by Steve Kornacki from MSNBC. He said almost at the exact same time, Hillary's biggest achievement tonight may end up keeping Biden out of the race. All right, I'll bite. Why did last night's debate serve to push Biden out of the contest?
Well, I mean, just based on the chatter, and no one has shown they've had any real pipeline into the Biden camp, but the chatter was, you know, if Hillary stumbles at the debate, if she stumbles at the Benghazi committee testimony next week, you know, Joe Biden will sort of be there in the wings to swoop in. This is part of the, you know, the collapse narrative that a lot of the press has been pushing. Yes, she has a big lead, but something's not quite right. This whole thing could just crater at any moment, which we've never really heard that kind of chatter about any other front runner campaign before. But the press was very sure that, you know, this whole thing could, again, just kind of fall apart and there would be Biden. But, anyone who was watching that debate last night showed, you know, I think they didn't come away with, gee, she's kind of shaky, or gee, this whole thing is kind of held together by tape. She came across as a very forceful, powerful woman who knew what she was doing and did not seem at all like her campaign was about to collapse in any way, shape, or form.
Heather Parton, before we go to the break, I was reminded last night watching the debate why Hillary Clinton did so well back in 2008. She's really good, it seems, in these debate settings. Not as good, it seems, in the speech settings, which is just out there giving a speech. I've been decidedly unimpressed by her over the past few months in this campaign. But last night, it was a reminder of 2008. Did you have that same sense?
Well, sure. I mean, I think she's been bizarrely, as Eric says, that she's been bizarrely sort of underestimated during this entire process. I mean, this is a long campaign. It's going to feel like it's gone on for a decade by the time it's done. And, you know, you have to pace yourself through these things. I mean, and the idea that somehow or another Clinton was just this abject failure because there have been ups and downs and, you know, because the Republicans came after her, I mean, please. Anybody who didn't expect that, even more so that the press wasn't going to be extremely hostile to her. They always have been. In fact, I'm looking right now at a quote from Mark Halperin from July of 2014. He was on Morning Joe, and he said, I don't like this. Remember, July 2014, so this is a while back, and mm-hmm. He says, I don't ever like to overstate the media's role, but the media has a pretty big role in the presidential process. I think Hillary Clinton's talking about what is the most important issue determining whether she'll be president right now. She'll raise the money. She'll have policy positions. She needs to find a way, we talked about this the other day, to change the narrative about how she's being covered. Right now, she's destined to get horrible coverage if she runs for president. I mean, this is Mark Halperin.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this was baked in the cake. And anybody who didn't see that coming was not paying attention. Clinton has always had to be a sort of a rope-a-dope survivor, one of these people who just takes the blows and keeps on going. And, you know, these things kind of come in waves. And so last night, you know, was I surprised to see her do well in a debate? Of course not. She's you know, a pretty, you know, major politician, been in many debates in her life. Mm-hmm. She's been around for a long time. She's a professional. She knows what she's doing.
Well,
I guess people thought she was going to, you know, crumble to the floor in tears, in a puddle of tears or something. I don't know.
Well, I didn't. Of course, I didn't think that. But I just forgot that in this setting, she is quite impressive, whereas I don't find her to be quite that impressive out on the stump at the rallies and so forth. But in these debates, she seems to be impressive, which is somewhat ironic due to the controversy about the party, the DNC, Debbie Wasserman Schultz trying to limit the number of debates and all of the other candidates calling for more debates. I think Hillary would be well served with more debates. In any event, I got to get to a break here. We will come back with much more. Eric Bollert, Heather Digby Parton, Desi Doyen, and of course me, Brad Friedman, right here on the Bradcast in our Democratic debate special. I'm Brad. Stay tuned.
You know, the issue is not whether or not you get knocked down, it's whether you get back up.
I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never gonna
Welcome
keep
back.
Me down.
This is your Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com here with you with our special debate coverage and my special guests, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and from Digby's Hullabaloo blog, and Eric Bollert from Media Matters. Okay, guys. Hillary was getting up again last night, but the big contest, the big question was, how would she and Bernie Sanders fare one-on-one? I kind of thought he was knocked off his game a little bit at the top, but when he was asked about the Black Lives Matter movement, and sort of a trick question, and this is clip number 7, Desi Doyen, it seemed to me sort of a trick question: do Black Lives Matter or do all lives matter? Here's what Bernie Sanders had to say in response:
Black Lives Matter. And the reason those words matter is the African-American community knows that on any given day, some innocent person like Sandra Bland can get into a car And then 3 days later, she's going to end up dead in jail. Or their kids are going to get shot. We need to combat institutional racism from top to bottom. And we need major, major reforms in a broken criminal justice system in which we have more people in jail than China. And I intend to tackle that issue to make sure that our people have education and jobs rather than jail cells.
That was Bernie Sanders last night on the stage in Las Vegas, the Democratic debate. He was, of course, tripped up by Black Lives Matter protesters over the summer. And Heather Parton, I think you might have been there. Were you there at Netroots when he was shut
I
down
was
by?
Not. No.
Oh, you weren't
I
there.
I wasn't. No.
Well, he was shut down by protesters at the Netroots conference. And as many see support in the African-American community as currently key to Clinton's frontrunner status, how did you think Bernie did in handling that question on Tuesday night? And is this what it's going to come down to, support within the African-American community between Bernie and fighting over that between Bernie and Hillary Clinton?
I thought his answer was good last night. I thought most of the I thought he did very well. And if you want to talk about the black votes, look, if you go back 8 years, he's in the same polling position where Barack Obama was versus Hillary Clinton. Fall into the fall or autumn before the Iowa-New Hampshire primaries, Hillary had a 20-25-point lead. You know, the question is Bernie Sanders going to be Barack Obama, or is he going to be more of a Howard Dean and a Bill Bradley in terms of when it comes time to winning elections? As you mentioned, the problem with Bernie Sanders, he's polling at 4% among blacks in South Carolina and things like that. So when you get away from Iowa and New Hampshire and you go into places like Nevada and in South Carolina, they're much more diverse. There isn't any indication yet he's going to be able to do what Obama did and peel away a whole bunch of voters from Hillary Clinton. But, but last night I thought Bernie was Bernie, and I thought he was great. And for people who had never seen him, who had just been hearing about who's this guy from Vermont, I can't imagine a lot of Democratic voters watched that and said, oh, he's not for me. I don't like him. Of course, I think that, talking about colleges and, college education and corporate greed and climate change, all those things. The problem strategically, he got a bit of a bad luck in that guns came up right away, mm-hmm. and Hillary just went right in. She did not pause. She did not say, well, I know and respect my friend from Vermont, and we have differences. She went in kind of with a she went in for a little kill there.
She did. Let's play a little bit of that exchange since that's come up a couple of times here. I think we have this exchange between Sanders and Clinton and O'Malley on guns right at the top of this debate.
You voted against the Brady bill, mandated background checks and a waiting period. You said that holding gun manufacturers legally responsible for mass shootings is a bad idea. Now you say you're reconsidering that. Which is it? Shield the gun companies from lawsuits or not?
Let's begin, Anderson, by understanding that Bernie Sanders has a D-minus voting record from the NRA. But I supported a ban on assault weapons, strongly supported instant background checks. There are thousands of people in this country today who are suicidal, who are homicidal, but can't get the mental health care because they don't have insurance or they're too poor.
Do you want to shield gun companies from lawsuits
or not? Of course
not. Secretary Clinton, is Bernie Sanders tough enough on guns?
No, not at all. I think that we have to look at the fact that we lose 90 people a day from gun violence. This has gone on too long, and it's time the entire country stood up against the NRA.
Because of the way that the NRA gets its way in our Congress, and we take a back seat, it's time to stand up and pass comprehensive gun safety legislation as a nation.
Senator Sanders?
I don't think I am pandering. But you have not been in the United States Congress.
So that was they were sort of fighting about a vote that was taken some years ago concerning whether to give immunity to gun manufacturers and so forth when their products kill people. Heather Digby Parton, how did he do that? Came right off the right at the top, and Hillary Clinton seem to go for the jugular on that issue. I'm wondering, is that going to hurt him in the Democratic primary? But is that one of those issues that could help Bernie Sanders if he became the nominee in the general election, that he's not completely anti-gun?
Well, you know, there are those who are making that case, that this is actually a strategy, and it kind of echoes the Howard Dean strategy back in 2004, thinking that maybe, you know, he could make inroads among the white working class gun owner types who might be interested in his, you know, in his views on trade and on jobs and on economics, but they are, you know, very, very attached to their guns. I really don't think that's the case. I think Bernie was dealing with a reality, which was in order to get elected, he had to do what the NRA wanted him to do most of the time. This is the truth. It happens all over the country. He's not the only one. And the most shocking thing is to see them actually having this argument in a presidential debate against the NRA. I really would never have guessed, you know, sadly, it's taken this, you know, this river of blood that we are seeing from mass shootings to wake people up that this is a problem. And it happened after 2000. I mean, there had always been this back and forth. The NRA went completely nuts in the 90s. Wayne LaPierre came in, and they became this hardcore obstructionist, take-no-prisoners organization. There was no room for compromise, and there still isn't. And in 2000, when Al Gore, you know, barely won, I mean, he won the popular vote, but he didn't win it by a large margin. Everybody claimed that this was because of guns, and the Democrats all backed off and decided that this was not going to be an issue that they would run on. Well, that's changed, thank God. Mm. And even Bernie is sort of stuck with the, you know, lingering sort of problems with that. I don't think it's a strategy. I mean, maybe it is, but it really doesn't seem like it. I think Bernie's a genuine person, a sincere legislator with integrity, and I think that this is the one case where he had to, you know, kind of cut around the margins a little bit, and he's stuck with it now because it was a big deal, and it is a big deal in his rural state. You know, having said that, I think that Clinton was smart to do this for the sake of the party and for the sake of the country and, you know, dead people on campuses around the country. And churches and elsewhere, that, you know, this is something that the Democrats have to start taking a very, very hard line. And I think that it was, of course, it's opportunistic for her to go after Bernie on this. But it is also a, you know, it is a place where this sort of points out where the Democrats have gone wrong in the past. And I'm sure she was, you know, part of that calculation in some ways, you know, sort of higher circles of Democratic Party politics. But it's changed, and that those days are over. And,
well, that's good news. Yeah.
It is good news.
It's
more of that what Eric was saying before. You know, I mean, here we are watching this very liberal debate. I mean, I can hardly believe it. I don't even. I'm going, oh my God! You know, look at what these people are saying. And, you know, we're debating democratic socialism and talking about Denmark, and even Hillary Clinton, who is as mainstream a politician as it gets, is, you know, running right alongside and doing all this. So this is good news. I really, all Democrats, all liberals, all people of conscience should be somewhat pleased here.
It does seem like good news. As I was watching last night, I'm thinking, of course, oh, man, well, this debate is going to do, you know, nowhere as well, obviously, as the Republican debate. They had a record 24 million or something viewers for that. But the numbers today, Eric Bollert, people are interested, apparently, in substantive debates, because I think it was a record for Democratic debate, 15 million, beating the previous record of something like 10 million. And that record came during the Obama-Clinton showdown that was so fantastic back in 2008. Does this mean America actually is interested in topics and substance, Eric?
Yeah, it's great, right? I mean, everyone was amazed by those Republican debate numbers, 24, 25 million. You know, that not only beat debate records, that beat CNN's highest program ever, you know, which was Ross Perot and Al Gore debating NAFTA, and they, like, doubled the ratings of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was through the roof, and why, right? It was Trump, it was insults, it was pie-throwing, it was a circus. You compare that to last night, and so that was 25 million last night, got 15 million. Very serious, interesting discussion. We should talk about the debates a little. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the DNC has been under a lot of pressure, getting hammered, not enough debates. DNC's trying to hide these debates. Why aren't they marketing them better? Mm-hmm. And I think today it just dawned on me, there's an argument to be made. You know, Hillary and Obama, this is not an exaggeration, I think they debated 18, 19 times.
Yeah.
2007, 2008. You do it that many times, people aren't going to tune in. So they're having six, and I think you create these media events. And my gosh, if you look at the numbers, what a typical Democratic debate a year before election was, whether it was John Kerry or Clinton and Obama, those debates were getting 1.2 million viewers,
right.
1.9 million viewers, because they were happening every 3 weeks, and people were just like, unless you're you know, on staff, you know, in the poli-sci department, I mean, seriously, who's going to watch all these?
Well, but
I think there's an argument to be made. The DNC kind of might have gotten it right here. You turn these into media events, you're getting 15 million people watching a debate. And personally, after watching that last night, I didn't feel like I needed another 9 or 10. Not that I'm opposed to more debates, but, you know, the size of the field, et cetera, et cetera. But, no, in general, so, you know, it was a great debate. It was a liberal debate, and a ton of people watched it. This is all good news up and down the line.
I think that is good news. And this is despite, I mentioned this in the opening, Anderson Cooper, I thought was sort of coming at pretty much every question from a, you know, kind of a right-winger angle, an inside, perhaps inside the Beltway angle, a villager angle, as Digby might describe it. And one of those issues that they were, of course, hammering was this email nonsense. And this is the clip that everyone's playing because, oh, gosh, Bernie came to the support of Hillary Clinton. Of course he did. This is a ridiculous issue. Let's play a part of that exchange, number six.
Let me say something that may not be great politics, and that is that the American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails.
Thank you. Me too.
You know, I go around the country, talk to a whole lot of people. Middle class of this country is collapsing. We have 27 million people living in poverty. We have massive wealth and income inequality. The American people want to know whether we're going to have a democracy or an oligarchy as a result of Citizens United. Enough of the emails. Let's talk about the real issues facing America.
Well, that was huge. And in fact, they did talk about the real issues. I got to get to a break here, but very quickly, Heather Parton, this email nonsense has been going on and on. The network, the mainstream corporate media is absolutely obsessed with it. I know you look into these matters. I know Eric does. I know you guys are always right on these things because you actually pay attention to the details. Is there anything here in this entire, I look at it as well, I find nothing in this email nonsense. It's just, you know, part of the next step of the Benghazi nonsense. I see no actual law breaking here. Can we put this thing to bed, or is this all Republicans have to go on for the next year?
Well, I wish we could, because I agree. The way you figure these Clinton-style scandals out is that you ask the person, what is it you think they did wrong? What's your theory here?
Right.
And they can never tell you, well, we're just looking and you got to see, and they did this thing and it was bad and it doesn't pass the smell test, and there's smoke, there's fire, and throw everything at the wall and make it stick. You know, it's just they have no real theory of what she allegedly was doing. We know what she was doing, what they think she was doing, which was, you know, saying something gossipy and juicy and really fun in those emails, and they want to dig around in them. That's it's a fishing expedition.
It's not a security issue. It's not an outrage that she had a private email server that they all knew about because they all received email from her.
Well, I mean, look, Colin Powell had a private email server. Jeb Bush had it. But, you know, I mean, this is like, you know, this at the time, I think people don't understand just how, you know, new all this stuff really is. The rules have not been explicit and haven't, you know, we're still evolving. And so, you know, this is, of course, this isn't a big deal. And anybody with, you know, any sentient being can see that this is a trumped up, to use a phrase, mm-hmm. Right-wing scandal, as Kevin Loose Lips McCarthy, you know, said that this was something they were doing for political purposes. And, of course, you know, we all knew that. So did the press. But the press is very intrigued by these emails, and they are very excited because they're looking for something, you know, juicy that they can hang on Hillary Clinton. You know, it's rare that you get a chance to go digging around in someone's private correspondence, and that's what they want to do, and that is what's getting them excited. So, I don't know if this has been put to bed, but I think Bernie did absolutely the best thing for himself and for Clinton and for the party and for the country in doing what he did, which is basically saying, look, this is nonsense, and let's talk about the real thing. And in doing that, I was looking at the faces of the moderators who were all kind of, because he basically took this out of the debate as and Lincoln Chafee tried to bring it back and hit Clinton very deftly, I thought,
I know. They're very disappointed. Don't worry. They'll continue talking about it, whether there's any real scandal there or not. I got to get to a quick break here. We will come back with our special coverage with Heather Digby Parton and Eric Bollert of last night's Democratic debate. And I want to talk about the two different planets that the two parties now seem to be on. And I want to get both of these guys' takes on whether Bernie is, in fact, the best person to run, the most electable Democrat, which is contrary to a lot of people's thinking. But if you pay attention to the issues, Bernie does line up with the American people as well or better than anyone else in the race. We're going to talk about that and more after this. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is your Bradcast. Yes, they were feeling the burn last night in Las Vegas, the very first Democratic presidential debate of 2016, which we are talking about right now on the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com here with you and with Heather Digby Parton from Salon and Eric Bollert from Media Matters and Desi Doyen, our producer, as always. And by the way, Desi Doyen, we will talk about there was finally some climate change issues came up.
Yeah, for
in a
once.
Debate.
I mean, for the first time, like, ever.
But I figure, you know, you're always here, so we will get to talk to you about that in the coming days and on the Green News Report coming up, although I found it very amusing that they had to go to a Facebook question.
Yeah,
for this,
God forbid a CNN anchor should ask that question themselves. They had to give to field that out to the audience.
And the ingenious question she came up with, the Facebook person, was, what would you do about climate change? That was what they had to go to a special Facebook. Where were we here? We were talking about the two parties. Heather Digby Parton, you wrote about this today, this morning at Salon, and how this debate really underscores the contrast between Democrats and Republicans. And you wrote, truth be told, they all seemed last night on the stage somewhat normal. And that there was little suspense. After all, nobody was waiting with bated breath to see what crazy thing one of these candidates would say next. Whereas the GOP is one big heaping mess of a political party right now. Two different parties, yet they're playing to the same America. How does this what happens here over the coming year? Do we have this huge divide? Are they just literally speaking to two separate audiences entirely at this point?
Well, you know, I don't know that they're speaking to two separate audiences. I mean, I suspect that there are a lot of people on both sides who are watching both arguments. But I personally don't see how this changes in the immediate future. I mean, there's a lot of structural reasons why this is happening, you know, and there are many people who you can go and read about if you want to, read their discussions of, you know, the House gerrymandering and the way the parties have polarized, and certainly the Republicans have gone way, way farther, a point which I would suggest was partially due to Democrats kind of constantly sort of moving to the right in some vain attempt to sort of keep up and try to find some middle. And this is where we're at now. So you see, I mean, these debates just could not be more different. You have, and we've, you know, all of us here on this show, unfortunately for us, have probably watched every single debate and have followed, you know, everything that they've done. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very obvious. I mean, you have this, this crazy clown show on the right, and, you know, led by Donald Trump and Ben Carson and Carly Fiorina. Their debates are these wild affairs where they're talking about, you know, is Rosie O'Donnell ugly and insulting one another and you know, going on about, you know, gory mayhem and you know, I mean, and every single one of them talking about, you know, we have to start World War III. The first day in office, I will be invading Iran. You know, I mean, this is just crazy stuff.
And I love the way you wrote about it, actually, at Salon. You said Republican America is a dystopian hellscape in which evil, violent foreigners are trying to kill us in our beds while rapacious, jackbooted government thugs try to wrestle our guns from our cold, dead fingers, and Planned Parenthood sociopaths are committing mayhem on children and selling the body parts. And that's just for starters. And that is kind of accurate, Heather. That is the way they are laying things out. And you contrast with the Democrats, which you say, well, we are a very powerful nation struggling with declining middle class and economic security at the hands of the ultra rich. And we need some energetic government intervention to mitigate income inequality and solve the looming crisis of climate change. Reasonable things. Eric Bullard, I got to say, of late, my assertion has been that the GOP is no longer a legitimate governing party. They have no legitimate governing philosophy. I think they're no longer a legitimate political party, or at the very best, they are a party that is coming apart at the seams before our eyes. They cannot. The two most powerful positions in the free world, President of the United States and Speaker of the U.S. House, and this party cannot come up with a single candidate, a single consensus candidate for either of these two powerful jobs. Why do we even take them seriously anymore? I'm serious. Why should we even bother watching the debates? Why do we even consider them a major party anymore?
Well, it certainly looks like they're heading towards the Barry Goldwater cliff. And that they are not, they're certainly not going to deal with reality or try to reform itself between now and 2016. They will run a Trump or a Carson or a Cruz Marco Rubio. And if you just look at electoral math, the country that just elected Barack Obama twice and is becoming even less white, that is not going to be a map that's going to be kind to the Republican Party. But, you know, and then I don't know, maybe after that they'll deal with it. You know, they pretended that they were going to deal with it after they were so shocked Mitt Romney lost in an electoral landslide instead of doing anything in terms of dealing with the Latino vote or anything.
Right.
Logical. They're you know, they're just sprinting towards the cliff. So, but what's interesting is,
and
you know,
I don't
why
mean
do
Eric.
Pay...
I don't even mean that, Eric, by way of saying that you know, I disagree with them, because I've always disagreed with Republicans.
Yeah, right.
I mean, they
no,
don't
yeah,
seem
right.
to be a legitimate party anymore.
Well, no, this and this is an outgrowth of a couple things. I mean, when Obama was inaugurated, they decided, you know, we are going to rip up everything, the rule book in terms of how Congress works, in terms of how cabinet posts are approved, how legislation is approved, how anything is approved. So they threw out any notion of, you know, public policy and things like that. So if you go back to the 90s, yes, they were crazy. Yes, there was Newt. Yes, there was the revolution. But there was still, like, this very vigorous brawl about, you know, about welfare, about guns, and all those things. If you look at now, there is no policy debate anymore on anything.
Right.
I mean, the Republican Party has walked away from all of that, and now, under Obama, and they've strictly become this sort of radical obstructionist. But when it comes to time to sort of fire up a national campaign, you realize they don't have, you know, the normal tools at their disposal, because they've either threw them all away or haven't used them in forever. And so, you know, that Republican bait just becomes sort of comical. So I and one last point about the press, you know, the press continues to grasp to this model. You know, they desperately want to tell the story of center-left Democrats are battling center-right Republicans, right? They've clung to that model for decades. If you watch that Republican debate, that is not a center-right party anymore.
Right.
And so the press is very nervous. They feel very, I think, restricted about what they can say about the Republican Party. If they tell the truth about what's happening, then, oh, my gosh, it's the liberal media bias, and they're going to come under attack. So it's obvious to us what's happening in terms of this Republican implosion. The press is very, very nervous and, frankly, just afraid to come out and tell the truth, I think.
And I think that is why they were so taken off guard by Trump's rise. And I actually, Heather was on this show, on the broadcast, the day that Trump got in. And we both sort of agreed that, hey, yeah, this Trump guy is probably going to do pretty well in what has become of the Republican Party. And meanwhile, the Beltway press just had no idea. They thought it was a joke. Oh, he's never going to, you know, he'll drop out next week. He's not going to be popular. They have been underestimating how far off the Republican Party has gone off the rails, I think, not just in this cycle, but now for years. And it drives me absolutely nuts that they treat them with the same regard as they always have, as if they're a legitimate party. I don't think they are. Anyway, I've got one more thought I want to run through both of you guys. Our legal analyst at bradblog.com, Ernie Canning, he's been making the argument that Sanders, and it's sort of an argument that a lot of the Sanders supporters are making, that Sanders is the best situated to win a general election against a Republican. And this mostly chalked up to the fact that polls show his positions on the issues really are most in line with the American public on issue after issue, whether the American public realizes that or not. So is he right? Does Ernie Canning have a point there that Bernie Sanders is better positioned to take on the Republicans, and that once America gets to see Bernie, many more people will come to appreciate that? Or is there something more than simply issues when it comes to presidential races in this country? Let's start with you, Heather, on that.
One would think so, but of course that isn't how politics in America works. There are two factors here. The first is that, you know, people vote for a lot more than just positions on issues. They vote on they have a whole set of heuristic characteristics that they look for in leadership, and there are many reasons why they might look at both Clinton and Sanders as either lacking or having those characteristics. So you can't, if it were all about people agreeing with the platform of your standard left-wing Democrat, that we would have a huge majority in the Congress, and we would never lose the presidential race because they always agree on an issue-by-issue basis. There's another part, of course, which is that Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton will not be running unopposed. And as a result, they will be defined, the other side will try to define them in certain ways. I suspect that Bernie Sanders, many votes, many comments, many statements he's made over the years will be used to portray him as something other than a mainstream person. Clinton as well, she'll be, portrayed as something other than a corrupt and evil human being, and then there's the press, which also puts their thumb on the scales as well. So it would be nice if it were that simple, but it isn't. So when you're making those assessments about electability, it's based upon a whole lot of other things. There is one thing that's very, very clear, though. If you are running for president, you have to assemble a coalition within your own party to win the nomination. And that coalition in the Democratic Party is a big, wide coalition full of very, many different kinds of people. At the moment, Sanders is lacking in his ability to assemble that coalition to beat Hillary Clinton. And it's the same problem that, ironically, Hillary Clinton had when fighting
Barack Obama back in 2008. And so unless he can do something about that, and I have no idea if he can. I mean, he seems very sincere to me on all those issues having to do with, you know, people of color and immigration and all this stuff. But that is the way you do it. And it's something you just sit there with a spreadsheet and go, who can I get to vote for me out of this big Democratic coalition, and how do I put together a majority? And so far, it does not appear from the polling that we've seen that Sanders has been able to do that, but we've got a long way to go. I wouldn't count him out.
Well, we do have a long way to go, but of course that has to do with the primary. And the question is, you know, if he is able one way or another to get that nomination when it comes down to the general election. I'm going to assume that that coalition, the African-American community that may be supporting Hillary Clinton right now, they're not going to start voting for the Republican in the general. So, Eric, I've got only about 30 seconds or so here, but let me get your take on this when it comes down to the general elections, they're going to attack whether it's Bernie or Hillary. They're going to throw everything they can at that candidate. So ultimately, is it issues or something else entirely these days that ends up determining a general election? And is Bernie better or worse situated than Hillary Clinton to win that general election?
Well, I think Heather is right on all those points. And look, I mean, when you get to the general election, let's just call it what it is. It's entertainment. I mean, this is an American pastime at this point. You can't just run on, you know, these policies match up with these policies. You got to have a star quality. You got to have an amazing production team behind you. For better or for worse, this is how it happens. You have to have the best. The question is, would Bernie be able to take on, you know, the onslaught? You know, one of the things that people noticed, I think a lot of people noticed at the debate last night was, wow, she's good. You know, just basically, she's really good. She's a pro. She's smart. She's quick on her feet. And as she emphasized, and she was talking to this point last night, I have faced these people, these Republicans, for 20 years, and I'm still standing and I'm still fighting. I think an implicit point might be, I don't think anyone on this stage would still be standing if they were under the kind of onslaught I and my husband have been. Clintons pride themselves on this. You cannot knock them down. We're going to keep fighting, and I think that's a legitimate point when you're talking about a general election and what Republicans will do when the White House is in play.
The fight and the entertainment will no doubt continue for a long, man, what are we, 11, 12, 13, 14 months ahead.
No.
Yes. Buckle up, Heather. Eric Bollert, senior fellow at Media Matters for America. Check him out. Of course, his work at MediaMatters.org and on the Twitters. You must follow Eric there, at Eric Bollert. And Heather Digby Parton, Digby from Digby's Hullabaloo. And, of course, Salon, check her Hullabaloo out at digbysblog.blogspot.com and on the Twitters at Digby56. Thanks, guys. Always great to talk to both of you, and I hope we will do it again soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn. And, of course, to Salon's Heather Digby Parton and Media Matters Eric Bollert. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can always download it at bradblog.com. We'll be back with you same Brad time, same Brad channel tomorrow. Until then, drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And follow me on the Twitters and the Facebooks at The Brad Blog. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. Everybody.